Hello. I love your work.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 23 for the week of March 10th, 2014. I am a friend for dinner, David T. Cole, and I'm here with psychotherapist Sarah D. Bunting.
Tell me about your marinade.
Lonely pooch, Tara Ariano.
Where am Will Graham?
And unintelligible Danish actor Nick Reinwell Jones.
Hey, this is good to be here. Yes.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Extra Hot Great. Sorry about missing last week, but our power pack for our mixer blew up thanks to an electrical storm here in Los Angeles. That is my theory, and I'm sticking with it. All right, before we get into it, a little site business. Site business number one. There is a gardener outside with some sort of electric motor. You will be hearing that through the podcast, I'm sure. We don't have much in the way of insulation here. All right, on to site business number two. The forums are open. They are being used. It is fun, but we need character threads started. We need, you know, shooting the shit threads started. So what I'm going to do to incentivize you, our listenership, to do this for us, because we got a lot of work to do, is if you create a thread, any thread, on the site for the next week, you will be entered in a pool for a whole slew of extra hot, great mini topic extra credits. Do it, Sarah.
Hello. Welcome back, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome back, our special guest, Nick Reinwald Jones.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you in person as well.
Yes, I'm actually here in beautiful Los Angeles, so some of the technical problems, knock wood, that we sometimes suffer for being on both coasts.
Although it is worth just mentioning, we only have three mics, so Tara and Nick have to share a mic. So if they're a little bit, you know, leany-inny on the audio, that's why.
But later on, we're going to harmonize in some old-timey radio songs.
Oh, yeah.
While I play the banjo. Except for the I play part. Anyway, speaking about horrors, we're talking about horror on TV this week, specifically Hannibal and Bates Motel. I thought we'd start with Hannibal, which I'm a big fan of, even though it's getting even more revolting.
I play
this season, especially with the Foley effects. I think that that's much worse.
Yeah, you're right. Year. I didn't really think about it until
the most recent episode, which aired just this previous Friday. The victim was trying to pry himself out of that. What, not to be rude, but looked like kind of an appetizer shrimp platter of dead people. And it was taking what felt like forever. They opened the show with this, too. There was no, like, let's get used to it with a little bit of Hannibal and Bedelia glaring at each other.
No, it was the cold open.
Yeah, and it was cold, all right? Mm-hmm. And open, mm-hmm. as in wounds. Mm-hmm. But then just the ripping sound effect. I'm just imagining the Foley team, like...
Yeah, what would that be?
What would they have used in old time? Like, now, of course, it's all computerized, but what would they have used back in the day for that, do you think?
To, like, the sound of flesh being ripped apart?
Would they have, like, gotten a... pig from
you could have glued together a couple of sides of beef probably and ripped them apart, because that's what happened. And then just when you're like, oh, he's glued on, and then you see he's actually not just glued, he's sewn to the next person in
but
the
then
sequence
he's like,
as well.
You could see that actor was great, because you could see that he was like, well, now I have to, like, I have to get out of here, but also he's like, oh, fine, like, of course, also I'm sewed on as well as, like, glued on.
Oh, my God, and there's a traffic boot on my foot.
Yeah. And there's a giant Frankenstein bolt through my cheek. But, yeah, it was really quite vile. But the show itself, like, I was a big booster of the show in its first season. I'm glad it got renewed. I'm not sure what they're thinking moving it to Friday.
Mm-hmm. Apparently this week it got beaten by a Full House rerun, so FYI.
Full House.
Well, that must have been one damn good Full House episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the one where Stephanie's glued in a line with... That's bad. I mean, and the
human oil centipede. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
I'm not going to talk anymore because I'm too busy barfing. But the show itself seems very slow. I mean, the acting is still wonderful. Mads Mikkelsen is still wonderful. His scenes with Gillian Anderson have been very fraught. She should get a guest star Emmy. She was obviously terrified. And that scene in the last episode where she's backing away from him and trying to be casual, and he knows that he has all the power in this conversation. I thought it was really great, but at the same time, it's feeling very slow. Mm-hmm. And at this time, I would like to cede the floor to one Dave Cole. When I propose that perhaps Will Graham is the Pierce of this show,
yeah.
Dave has feelings. Dave.
Oh, okay. Well, my big problem with season one was I thought they had one note, which is his very slow descent into madness. But what they, and very slow, you know, 12 episodes, whatever it was, but that the overall progression of the plot just was in these little loops. If you imagine, like, it was like, you know, a strand of what's her face's hair from Brave, you know, it was just very coily, and it kind of just went in a loop. Like, it went forward a bit and looped around, went one step backwards, two steps forward, one step backward, two step forward. And at the end of the season, we really weren't that much ahead of where we were at the start. All we know is that all the things that Hannibal liked to cook, and really there wasn't a lot of circumstantial change from episode 1 to episode 13, except for the fact that finally Will, you know, was successfully set up for this. But it didn't need 13 episodes to set that season A plot up.
No,
and the B plots of, like, serial killer accolade of the week was sort of like, it's there, and I know it's part of the grander mythos of the, whatever you call it, the Hannibal universe, you know, the Red Dragon universe. But as the main drive for the series, Will is such a boring character. He is not, to me, not interesting. I was really hoping that they were going to maybe dispense with him. I don't really know if, maybe you can answer this, if Hannibal is following a prescribed existing timeline. I don't think they are. I think they're just using characters and doing their own general thing with it, right?
I don't know that much about the other Lecterverse, so yeah. Maybe someone else wants to jump in, but yeah. My understanding is, like, I have some sympathy for the fact that they, in the first season, were dithering a little bit because,
yeah.
A, they don't know if they're going to be picked up, and right. B, I think they just didn't. Brian Fuller just is more concerned with making these beautiful, like, thought
right.
pictures yeah. than he is in an actual plot that he didn't come up with. And I think that's generally true. This is the only thing he's done that I've yeah. even liked. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a, you know, eventually we know Hannibal gets caught.
Right.
Like, we've all seen Silence of the Lambs. It was on TV 3 times yesterday. So we know he gets caught, and there are some characters in there who get et, and that's fine. But it does seem like they should have
get et.
I'm from the Middle West.
New Clarkwear t-shirt coming soon. Get et.
Cha-ching. But yeah, I feel like that could have been planned better in terms of, are we driving towards his being apprehended and becoming this iconic character, or is this
yeah.
a totally different Lecterverse, or maybe he doesn't even get caught?
I'm fine with that. I just think that Will is neither a worthy adversary for Hannibal or a sympathetic character, so I'm not quite sure what his positive force for us, the viewership, is.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think the great thing about Silence of the Lambs is that Clarice is a great protagonist, but Hannibal is a great antagonist / antihero, and you really like watching both of them, whereas on Hannibal is very detestable, and Will is just boring, and, you know, it's that I really think they go to great lengths to make him much more detestable than he was in Silence of the Lambs. So it's like, you're not really rooting for Hannibal exactly, but it's hard to root
for
Will.
Yourself. I don't detest him at all. Like, I think they are trying. I think you're right. But Mads Mikkelsen has this dark charisma that's so fantastic, mm-hmm. and then his outfits alone. Like, he's
really
putting a leg through the meat slicer, and I'm like, that's
Grandma's
hot.
Couch cover hazmat suit in the
I know,
last
it should, it's like a hunting lodge from 1974. It's hot. It would look great on my floor. Sorry, husband.
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that they don't have a protagonist for Hannibal that works, you know, on a personal level for me, for the audience, makes Hannibal that much more of a sympathetic character. Or not sympathetic, but at least he's somebody you can root for in the absence of somebody actually good.
Well, this is always the villain problem.
Yeah.
Like Luke Skywalker v. Vader. But on the other hand, the show is not called Will Graham. So right. are we, like, is that part of the build? Is it we are supposed to think that Will's kind of a wet end? I'm asking. I don't know.
I don't know. I kind of wish that I do not like when shows do the fast forward, zip back thing they did in episode one with the fight with Lawrence Fishburne's character.
Jack
Crawford.
Jack Crawford, of course. I don't like that. I never find it necessary, and I didn't find this one necessary either, why we needed to know that, beyond the fact that the first episode had very little action. You know, if anything, they thought they would just stick that in there. That was their Star Destroyer chasing, you know, the Rebel Corvette.
And as usual, great Matrix-y fight, but...
Yeah, Lawrence Fishburne still has all the moves.
I don't know why we needed to know that was going to happen for me to be interested in everything else. Now I kind of feel like, well, can we just get to that point so I can be surprised with the end game again? And I feel like if they had to do anything with that, I would have liked to fast forward to Will's fate. And then at least we can know it and see the machinations that led us to that and then get past it.
Yes. He's a head in a jar. Next.
I wonder if we would feel the same about Will if he were cast with a different actor that had a bit more charisma. Like, to me, Hugh Dancy is such a, like, British-y little sprite of a person.
Yeah,
that he doesn't
kind of
have the right heft to go up against this or any Hannibal to me.
Yeah, I feel like he does need to be physically larger.
Yeah.
Like, Fishburne, I was not on board at first because, A, I did not like him when he replaced Gil.
Right.
In CSI, and that wasn't why. He just didn't, like, fit. Mm-hmm. Seems to fit in this universe. Mm-hmm. I like what he's doing. And also, that fight was amazing because he's quite brawny.
Yeah.
So maybe they just needed someone... I mean, not to put Benedict Cumberbatch in everything, but hey, why not?
Yeah. I mean, if they were going to insist on having a British actor with it, which I have a problem with personally, his American accent has gotten a little better since the first season, but it's still pretty bad. There's a lot of hard R's. But, like, even a Paul Bettany would have been more of a match for Mads Mikkelsen, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Conceptually.
Hannibal is a very dark character, and Will is just a very sort of confused character. Like, it would have been nice if Will Graham was perhaps the character he is plus not giving shit about the rules or something like that, right? Where he had a advantage over Lecter insofar that he could use... You know, he has the power of the FBI, plus he's willing to go that extra mile outside of, you know, the law type of thing. But he's sort of like at once a goody two shoes and has this muddy darkness to him that really isn't an equal to Hannibal's power.
Well, and is beleaguered by this special ability that he has. Like, could people like this on TV just be psyched?
Yeah.
That it's like...
It's a curse.
Fucking A. If I can't work for the FBI, I'm going to make a ton of money in the private sector.
If you were the guy from Dead Zone, wouldn't you be going around touching people all the time?
Yes.
Like, you're like, dude, you fall
receipt.
In the toilet.
Yeah.
How embarrassing for you.
Yeah. Be more careful.
Yeah.
Chew your food.
Yes. If you're going to lean over the throne before you have to vomit, just make sure you're not sleepy. That's my advice to you. And then he touches you, you know, touches somebody else. Yeah. I like the show because it is just like one of those what the fuck viewing experiences, but I really wish there was more of an even matchup between the two leads. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, in the original movie that was made from the same material, Manhunter, that was William Peterson playing Will Graham. So there's like this interesting CSI, like Hannibal
Mobius
crossover stuff because like William Peterson played the Will Graham role originally and then Lawrence Fishburne replaced him and now Lawrence Fishburne is on this show. So that's
all a circle of ew.
But for all its flaws, you know, with a character matchup, this show really nails the grossness portion of the horror recipe. Cause damn, that thing with the glue. Like, they've had more visceral things, but that guy getting out of the glue trap was disgusting. Like, that was a through the finger tented parted fingers watch.
And then the food is delicious looking even though you just saw where, and you've known all along where it's been coming from, but in this episode they made it absolutely no doubt, like,
and
some also Lego, enjoy. And I was like, I don't even eat meat, kind of feeling snacky now.
And
it's
the
fucked up
the trope of both Hannibal Lecter films and just generally of the crazy serial killer doing things to classical music, very overplayed.
Oh.
But the leg thing, I enjoyed the leg moment with the bump, 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 bump.
It was very matter of fact.
Yeah.
I would just like to say, I don't know what it says about me, that when the actual very, very white murderer ended up in the middle of the design, I was like, that's so wrong. I was glad that Will picked it out because I was like, they totally ruined it. This beautiful design, which is sick. And, you know, if you came over and saw my bookshelves, you would know why, because they are also organized by color and they look great. Just like this guy's horrible, disgusting, awful, wrong, psychopathic Pantone wheel of human flesh tones was. And yet, I kind of felt for him at the end being sewn into it in the exact wrong spot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the killer was going to be revealed to be the CEO of Benetton, and that was like this new advertising.
We're united,
scheme.
All right. Oof.
So we have one more horror entry to talk about?
Well, not only another horror entry, but another prequel to a very well-known horror property, which is Bates Motel. It tells a version of a Norman Bates origin story, except it's set in contemporary times, which is kind of weird.
That took me a while to figure out. I had not been watching the show, so I watched the premiere, and it took me a minute to, like, when is this supposed to be set? Well, and then she has a cell phone, and I'm like, oh, okay.
The same thing happened in the series premiere, where he's waiting for a bus, and it could be any time, and he's dresses in that weird, dorky way, and so does she, kind of. She has that weird, like, anytime sort of vintage-y look to what she wears, but then you see him with a cell phone or an iPod or something, and it was the same thing.
Right.
I guess the point is that it doesn't really matter when it's set, or it would be too hard to do a full period piece in no town, British Columbia, wherever they shoot this pretending to be Oregon. It is not as successful. I'm not really sure why I'm still watching it, but I am. I guess because of Vera Farmiga, who I used to hate and somehow I find fascinating in this role.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what they were trying to do with Norma. Like, is she supposed to, are we supposed to be for her or against her? I kind of couldn't figure it out. And I'm with you. Like, I really used to hate Vera Farmiga. I think it was The Departed where I started to like her, even though that role is for shit. I mean, whatever, Scorsese, but she did well with it. And then Up in the Air, I thought she was great. That was another movie that sort of sold out the character, but I came around on her. And after like 20 minutes of watching her as Norma, I was like, what are you trying to do? Like, are you supposed to be this flaky person that we find really frustrating? And if we're not rooting for you, who do we root for?
Yeah, there is no mastermind in this show. I mean,
the freeway progress.
Yeah. Yes. The bypass. Oh, yes. The bypass.
Go bypass, go bypass, go.
God, but
I bought the transit system only to dismantle it.
Yes, but Norman is a little bit Will Graham-y in that, like, he's frail and we don't really know what his deal is, and he has blackouts and he doesn't know what he was doing during those blackouts, and maybe he was murdering people. And then Norma, I thought in season one, was like, she kills somebody pretty quickly. Granted, it's someone who is raping her and she murders him, like, in her kitchen. And it's Dan Doherty from Deadwood, by the way. Mm-hmm. So he's his latest in a string of scumbag characters that he plays, I guess. But anyway. And then she's sort of like, you know, like you would expect a mother of a Norman Bates as seen in Psycho to be, like, she's really overprotective and stuff. But at the same time, I sort of thought that it was going to be like a Sante and What's-His-Face Kimes kind of situation where she was also a murderer.
Right. Okay.
But it's not, I mean, maybe that's where they're going, but they're not there yet. And so now it's just a lot of her, like, trying to protect him because she thinks he maybe is probably maybe a murderer, maybe. And then she's not really sure. And so she's trying to, like, cover it up, but she's not really sure what she's covering up, and neither is he. So it's very vague at the center of it.
So what was the, overarching plot for season one? Just here are these people, they're fucked up?
Kind of. There was, like, the bypass thing actually came up in season one, believe it or not, and then they suspended it. But then there's also all this stuff with the brother and the weed business that runs the town.
Oh, yeah.
And then she got involved with this. Oh, yeah. And there was a human trafficking plot, too. There was somebody who was keeping sex slaves in the basement somewhere. And she got involved with, like, the sheriff who was in on it. And then he got killed. I forget who killed him. I think the brother.
Have you ever done the Oregon Coast Drive? All those little weird half-dead towns on the coast?
Yeah, like back in the day on family vacation.
Oh, they're exactly the same, I'm sure. And yeah, I can believe most of this stuff happens in a town like that. We stopped in a few where it seemed like there was more homes here than people, and it's very quiet. And even though you're only 3 minutes from the highway, you might as well be 10 miles.
Like, and it has an abandoned quarry. And yeah. that's where everyone is.
Cliffs
drinking.
Of plenty.
Yep. Well, it's sort of, I mean, it's like California. It's like, it's, you know, half crunchy granola types and half live free or die types. Like, get off my land, people.
Yeah, yeah. It's a heady mix.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, like I said, I am still watching it. I'm not sure why.
Hmm. How's it doing?
I think not great.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I also hadn't seen it prior to this, and I read all of the summaries on Wikipedia, and my eyes just kind of like kept going like wider and wider. So I'm like, yeah. Oh, they went there. They went there.
Yeah.
They went there. Wow, right. They went everywhere. And then,
because you're a Hitchcock guy.
I do like Hitchcock. I have to say Psycho is not my favorite movie of his, mm-hmm. and I'm not a fan of this show, possibly for...
What is your favorite movie of his?
North by Northwest.
Okay.
Interesting.
But... I just found it really weird, as a lot of things about it, especially that it seems to be so focused on teens, which is weird for like a show that's trying to be kind of Hitchcockian. And also, like, there's all these characters and only two of them are supposed to pay off. Like, if you compare it to Hannibal, they really focus on it being about like the two characters that are really part of like the Hannibal universe. But on this show, it's like, well, there's this random girl and this other random girl and this guy and this pot grower and all this other stuff. You know, it's just kind of spread a little thin, I thought.
Right, yeah, it kind of shows its premise might not have been meaty enough for a full series.
Yeah, I think that's it.
One of the creators is Carlton Cuse of Lost, so that should probably alarm all of us, really.
Yeah.
I am duly alarmed.
We're going around the dial.
I had put down Believe as a placeholder here, and then I watched it, so let's not talk about Believe. True Detective! Finale was last night. And then, Dave, I think you had some points that you wanted to dovetail on this, too, but what did we think? Sarah, you wrote a great post about it.
Oh, thank you very much. I really liked it. I think that the sense I'm getting from reading some other reviews is that some people didn't feel that the whole Carcosa thing paid off that well, and that the ending was a little bit cheap, like, because... we all came to love them so much, and they were allowed to live. I thought that was the riskier choice, actually, was to have them live, especially since it was very clear that Rust wanted to die, and that was still a thing that was happening in the final episode. Mm-hmm. And the story has always been about those two, and it kept being about that, and there was some resolution, but other things weren't resolved. There was a line of dialogue talking about that. It wasn't perfect, but I thought it was very satisfying. It was a good ending. It didn't try to be anything it wasn't. It didn't try to sort of, at the last minute, be like, oh, and here's what's happening with the female characters, which I know has been some people's complaint. I'm not sure I buy that part. I thought it was great. I can't wait for it to come back. I hope they don't bring these characters back, because it's just going to be disappointing.
I think they already said they're not, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an anthology. So.
There's a difference between window dressing and the actual substance of the plot. And I feel like the internet kind of flipped the script on that one, where they got too invested in the window dressing part of it. Like, suddenly it was, you know, it was from the fantastical about, oh, it's a Lovecraftian thing, to, you know, the Yellow King is this. And what they're doing is this is a police case. They are working it. And these are just the facts that come in and out of working a case.
And these are all related, let's keep in mind, to somebody like a murderer and child molester.
Yes.
Like, you can't necessarily ascribe a working thematic structure narratively to that guy. It's probably random.
Yeah.
Could have been Mr. Stay Puft.
Yeah, and you can't necessarily just say everything you talk about has to fold back into plotting everything on a line after it's done. Police cases don't work like that. Things come and go. Leads appear and then die in the vine. And I kind of like that about the show, that they're not the police detective equivalents of the Avengers, where they can do anything and everything works out for them. They're not the guy who can, you know, guns akimbo and shoot three people with two shots and all. You know what I mean? They're human people working on a case, and I thought the show did a really good job of kind of showing the flaws and sort of the imperfect nature of that, but also the setting and the people. You know, like, it all seemed, I don't want to say real, because obviously it's a fantastic story you know, if you take it on face value. But certainly it seemed more real than a lot of the stuff that A is on TV and B.
Well, it felt truthful.
Truthful. Thank you. Yeah. That is perfect way to put it.
Yeah. I also I was glad that it didn't end up being, I mean, like, those theories are sort of fun to read as far as they go, I guess, but I was glad that it didn't end with a sort of, like, usual suspects, and here are all the pieces that you were supposed to, like, so dumb. Like, it's fine enough for it to just be what it is.
And I felt like they gave the cops that one thing in the last episode where, here's the one piece we overlooked that lets us finally connect it, as opposed to a lot of shows where is, here's the 12 things.
Yeah.
That are going to happen. Like, oh, and by the way, this organization also, you know, is led by the father of the daughter of the girl who was in the boat and on the moon, right? I mean, there's just like, it
and
didn't
her
stretch.
Her sister is your ex-wife, and yeah.
Yeah. It just, that part of it felt, as you say, truthful to me, that they're working a case and this is what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of the truthfulness of it. I mean, I think it's, if you compare it to Hannibal, which is not a show that I love, I think it's just great how it shows that these kinds of crimes are solved by actual human beings that you may not like in real life, and they may be kind of detestable in some ways, but they are committed to the job. I mean, that's the only aspect of it that makes it a little less realistic than, say, The Wire, is that they're really, like, it's so important to these two guys that they will devote the, like, years of their life to it.
And Russ's character is, you know, obviously heightened, and he's, you know, more of an idea than a character at points, you know, as far as, you know, he's kind of a walking, spouting, you know, quote machine.
But, I mean, I thought, and I wrote this too, that there's a hopefulness to that. Like, as my grandmother used to say, every pot has its lid. And these two guys who are, you know, kind of horrible, sort of detestable, as you said, outright detestable in many ways in Marty's case, but they fit together, and they make something more than the two of them apart.
You got a law stew going on.
Yeah. And it's almost 20 years old, this crime, and they came back to it and they solved it. Finally, like, I thought that there was it's interesting that you bring up The Wire, because I think that is a wonderful show and probably my favorite, but also very bleak about how it views humans and institutions. So,
yeah. And what did we think about the very end, the post-crime hospital scene?
I loved it. I love that they're hobbling off into the non-sunset together. I think it's great.
I thought it was perfect. Marriage is hard.
Yeah. I mean, and it was a nice way of kind of hanging a lantern on some of the ridiculous stuff that they survived for Marty to just say, well, you've proven yourself unkillable, so I guess I'm not worried about you.
Yeah. One of my criticisms after the first episode was that I liked it and I could tell it was trying something very ambitious, but I wished that there had been more humor in it. And then I realized over the course of it how subtle it was, because it was so dry. And it wasn't really until the end that you sort of see that relationship come into focus and, like, what they really think of each other. So I agree with I agree with your post. I thought it was an excellent encapsulation of the season, and I'm excited for the next one too.
Like Tara, I am changing what I was originally going to write.
Oh, shit!
Well, I was going to say, my original one, Scandal, is bullshit. I quit. I could list the reasons why, but I'm sure you all understand what they are. I would like to talk about the piece that Tara just forwarded me from our frequent contributor, Jeff Drake.
Oh.
He didn't write it, but he sent it to us about the upcoming Mad Men season and the grand unifying theory of how he's actually D.B. Cooper, which I just
Speaking of crackpot internet theories.
Oh my God, I am such a crackpot, I don't even care. I love the D.B. Cooper story, which, if you're not familiar, it's like the last great hijacking of the golden era of hijacking, which happened in 1971, and he keeps popping up in pop culture, like Prison Break and stuff like that. Like, he got on a plane, he asked him to fly to Seattle, I guess. He let all the passengers off. He herds the crew into the cockpit. And when they finally land later, like, he's taken his $200,000, dropped the back stairs of the plane, and jumped off. They found some of the money and some shreds of parachute, but they never found him. And so it's like Elvis, you know, buying cigarettes in Kokomo level. Like, people are still spotting him everywhere. Right. And this theory, which who wrote this again?
I don't know. I didn't notice.
Whoever you are, you're
we'll
brilliant.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Yes. You're brilliant, and I hope that you're right, because I think it would just be such a wonderful way to bring it around. I'm sure that Matt Weiner, let's call the whole thing off, is like too vain to go in that direction and to give himself up to like an actual story. But I just want it to be true so badly. Such a fun true crime story. Have you guys read this? Do you think there's anything to it? Do you hope there's anything to it? Discuss.
I can't sign off on it because the one and only true DB Cooper is from News Radio.
I was just going to say that too. There's a News Radio episode where they suggest that Jimmy James is DB Cooper.
And I also
that's
like
where
that.
He got all his money.
I don't think these theories
they don't necessarily have to be
we have to
mutually
check
exclusive.
The,
we don't know that DB Cooper died.
There you go.
We got to check the Westfall universe to see if Mad Men.
Oh, yes.
If Mad Men and News Radio are in the same universe, only one of them could be DB Cooper.
But yeah, I've read that, and I think it's brilliant, and the parallels are uncanny, but, you know, there's no way that Matt Weiner would go that way.
No,
yeah.
Matt, and Don Draper is not going to end in triumph.
Right.
Well, but we don't know D.B. Cooper lived.
Well, but we hope he did.
I mean, I know in my heart he lived.
Call me Sarah D. married him.
Look forward to Sarah D. Bunting's D.B. Cooper Mad Men spec script. Coming to you.
I think
soon.
The term you're looking for is fanfic. Yeah. Anyway,
I was trying to class it up for you.
Don't bother.
All right.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I'm not a crackpot, but the American series should have ended because there is no way that the male spy. When he's in Clark and Martha mode.
His name is Philip.
I know, but he's Clark when he's with
when
Martha.
When he's Clark, yes.
That his ruse can survive their fake marriage. How has his wig not come off during playful banter, a shower, sex, a visit to the water park? There are so many ways. A high gust of wind. There are so many ways that
just being
looking
too
at
hard
it,
even.
Looking at it, there's no way that this wig can survive scrutiny.
Well, and especially
he should have been discovered. She works for the FBI. She would have reported it. He would have been captured. The ring would have collapsed. The Soviet Union would have. Oh my God! This is what brings it down, isn't it?
Well, the season premiere also establishes like that his wig can come off because they show him having a fight and the guy snatching his wig literally.
What if Martha takes? They visit her parents again, and her dad goes, "Hey, you little rascal!" And does that thing where you,
an overly aggressive scruffle could ruin the whole thing. Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, so
aggressive scruffle is my new band name.
I am not a crackpot.
That should be the title of this episode.
But I've just laid waste to the whole American series, and you could all stop watching.
So I wanted to mention, just coming out in the TV news this past week, Mary Louise Parker has finally chosen her next show to star on, and it's called Feed Me. It's an NBC sitcom, I believe, and it is about, she plays a chef in a restaurant, and kind of her whole extended family comes to support her in the restaurant because I think her marriage has just fallen apart. And you can see that I did a lot of research on this. that there's an alien, I think. I don't know. it's also from Tony Thomas and Paul Unger-Witt, who are like two of the like TV veterans from like sitcoms long ago. And they haven't done a lot in like the past 10 or 15 years. So it'd be kind of interesting to see them bring a more kind of old school aesthetic to it. But
I was going to say they're Golden Girls, aren't they?
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
What happens when Mary Louise Parker meets Golden Girls for Sarah D. Bunting?
For Sarah D. Bunting, she's going to wait for Tara Ariano to vet it.
Okay.
And be like, you will still not like her in this. Stay away.
All right, everybody. It is time for the canon. And Nick, you have brought us something? Please tell us what it is.
I have. I have brought Gilmore Girls Season 1, Episode 6. It is called Rory's Birthday Parties. And
is this our first Gilmore Girls submission? I think it.
No, I had seen another one in the canon.
There's another one.
Yeah, but okay. this is the only one from the first season, I believe.
Yeah, it's a season. It was one of the season finales.
All right.
All right, I'm going to have to reposition a little bit here so I can read from my notes. There we go. So to begin with, I just want to make some historical notes about this episode. It's from November of 2000, so obviously it's very early into the run of Gilmore Girls. Also, though, pretty early into the run of the WB itself. It's from the era when the WB was mostly known for pretty safe teen shows, which is essentially what it stuck with until it merged with UPN and formed the CW. That's when we got edgier shows like Gossip Girl and stuff. This is a long time before all that. So they're playing it much safer in these days. And I'm not saying all this to imply that we should be grading this on a curve, but because I think this is a really good example of how you can do a very interesting and compelling and emotionally authentic show while playing within pretty safe boundaries. So we begin this episode, like so many, during a Friday night dinner with Emily and Richard, and the first unusual thing that comes up is that they're serving pudding for dessert, which Lorelai thinks is a very un-Emily thing to do. And since she and Rory really like pudding, Lorelai sees this as kind of an olive branch, that her parents are trying to get to know them better and appeal to their interests more. And even though Lorelai's emotions are usually hidden behind 10 layers of snark, we can see that this means a lot to her because she brings it up several times over the course of the episode, and it's also an indication of just how icy things have been between her and her parents so that she considers this such a big deal. One other thing to note here, there's no incompetent housekeeper scene that we usually get in those dinner scenes, which I am totally fine with. I never cared for those. It felt way too sitcom-y. Anyway, after dinner, Lorelai pulls Emily aside to tell her that she wants to postpone the next week's Friday night dinner because it's Rory's birthday and she wants to have a party in Stars Hollow for her. And she pushes pretty hard on this, but as always, you should never bet against Emily Gilmore in a negotiation. It's ultimately decided that Rory will have two parties, one on Friday at Emily and Richard's house and one in Stars Hollow on Saturday, hence the title of the episode. So Lorelai breaks the news to Rory in the car.
So is this party Grandma's having going to be a big deal?
Not really. The government will close that day. Flags will fly at half-mast. Barbara Streisand will give her final concert. Again. Uh-huh. Now, the Pope has previous plans, but he's trying to get out of them. However, Elvis and Jim Morrison are coming, and they're bringing chips. You ask a simple question.
And as it turns out, Lorelai isn't really exaggerating, because unbeknownst to either of them, Emily has invited every student in Rory's grade at Chilton, which, as she says later in the episode, is because she assumes that Rory is friends with all of her classmates. And that's probably equal parts snobby upper-classness and just regular good-natured style grandmotherly cluelessness. But in any case, this brings on the first appearance of Tristan, who tells Rory about the mass invite and says he'll be there, and also takes the opportunity to flirt with her. And I think it's safe to say that at this point in TV history, Chad Michael Murray probably did have the most punchable face on television long before the days of Pete Campbell. Thankfully, he doesn't have too big a part in this episode. There's this brief exchange, and there's another one at the party. And as long as we're on the topic of people who aren't in this episode very much, I'm also glad that floppy-haired Dean only gets about a minute or two total of screen time.
It's so floppy.
It's really floppy.
I didn't know.
But I guess that's what people are into back then. I don't know. I was not dating back then. I did not have floppy hair, so, you know, maybe.
Maybe that's why you weren't dating.
That was the reason I was striking out, yes. If I had floppier hair, a totally different Nick history. Anyway. In technical terms, Dean was a great boyfriend and sweet and caring, but it's just an example of how you can make a character like that, like, be likable technically, but just fall flat
despite
on the screen.
Despite his hair.
Yeah, despite his hair. Okay. But just fall flat, because that's not the kind of character we want to be watching. But I digress. So meanwhile, Emily asks Lorelai to go birthday shopping for Rory with her because she really wants to get Rory something good. I think it's worth pointing out that for all of Emily's fretting about getting the perfect gift, we later see that Richard just gives Rory an envelope with money in it, actually twice, and she is fine with that, so maybe Emily didn't have to think so hard. But anyway, we get a lot of entertaining banter about what Emily thinks would be a good gift versus what Lorelai actually knows would be a good gift, and here's a little snippet of that debate.
She's a young girl. Think of something young.
A Mont Blanc pen.
Put on her desk at the law firm. She needs to write. Well, not with a $200 pen, she doesn't. Oh, hey, look. These day planners are adorable. Could get her one of those funky erasers with the mermaid on it. She'll love that.
Please be serious. We're shopping for Rory.
No, Mom, I'm shopping for Rory. You're shopping for your imaginary granddaughter, Barbara Hutton.
I want to get her something nice.
I know you do, but you asked for my help and you're not listening to me.
Well, you wanted me to get her a Filofax and a mermaid eraser.
It's one suggestion.
Oh, yes, and there was the t-shirt with the Farrah Fawcett face.
A hero to many who aspire to the perfect feather flip.
Sorry, I just need to break in here. I love that the reference is Barbara Hutton, because Amy Sherman-Palladino writing it must have been like, this is a half a percenter. It's not even a one percenter of people watching the show that are going to get that reference. And she did it anyway, and I love it.
And I still laughed. Yeah.
And that's actually about what, just what I was about to say. It was one of those old-timey cultural references that flew right over my head, and I had to look it up on Wikipedia. Apparently, Barbara Hutton was a Beverly Hills socialite born in 1912, married seven times, and the heiress to the Woolworth retail empire, the more you know, sparkle. And that's how the show rolls. But yeah, Amy Sherman-Palladino, I actually saw her on a panel many years ago where she talked about that. She said in the beginning, the network would give her a lot of notes about viewers not understanding these old-timey references. And eventually, she just kept putting them in the scripts, and they finally just gave up because they didn't want to have to keep calling her, so she won. So after school, Rory meets Lorelai at the dinner, and she's all ready to unleash her total frustration with Emily for having sent out these invitations to all the students without consulting her. But then Lorelai starts talking about what a nice time she had shopping with Emily and how she really feels like they're growing closer, and instead Rory just keeps her tirade to herself. When I was on the podcast last time talking about Big Love, I mentioned how that episode had a lot of TV tropes in it, but they used them well. They were deployed in a believable way, and I think this scene is another good example of that. The whole, I have something to say, so do I, okay, you go first, oh, never mind, thing is one of the tropiest tropes that ever troped, but this is really keeping with Rory's character because she's a parentified child. We see all the time that she worries more about her mother's welfare than her own, and so it makes sense to her to keep this to herself and not upset her mother. So we move on to the first of Rory's birthday parties, which is, of course, crazy, unmitigated, over-the-top opulence, Emily and Richard style, and as she and we predicted, Rory is mortified to have all her classmates there, most of whom she barely knows. And this is before she was even frenemies with Paris, let alone actual friends. But the funny thing about all this, which is kind of just presented without comment in this episode, is that it's really only Rory who feels awkward about it, because all the other Chilton kids are totally used to this kind of party, and just being kind of shuffled around different events by their parents, so they aren't really fazed by it. But then to add insult to injury, after Rory's already been forced to endure the more obnoxious flirting from Tristan and all this other stuff, Emily tells her that she has to make a speech to her guests, and Rory finally cracks.
Oh, there you are.
I think it's time that you said a few words to your guests.
What?
Just a little speech to say thank you and tell everyone how it feels to be 1 year older.
Mom, I don't think
she's the hostess, Lorelai. This is her responsibility.
I am not the hostess. You are.
Hey, honey, hold on.
This is your party, and these are your guests, and I don't have anything to say to them, so you give the speech.
Rory?
Excuse me. What's that all about?
Lorelai, your daughter has no manners whatsoever. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Okay, how did this become my fault?
And as I can remember, this is one of the few instances where Rory actually does stand up to her grandparents. And I say bravo to Rory on this one, because no one in the right mind would think that a real 16-year-old girl would want a party like this. And I think it's impossible to argue this is anything other than Emily just fulfilling her own idea of what a fancy party is. And it seems like most of the people there, aside from the classmates, are just aren't even people Rory knows. They're just like other socialites and stuff.
But they all came with envelopes full of cash, so who can really be that mad at them?
Cash, yeah.
They're all named Polly, or...
I know, yeah, it's the Godfather wedding all over again. Yeah.
By the time it was finished, I thought I was drunk.
So Rory finally tells Lorelai that she knew about the party in advance, and it was dreading it, and didn't tell Lorelai to spare her feelings, and Lorelai tells her that she doesn't have to do things like that, but of course we'll see over the course of the series that Rory does kind of need to do that, because her mother is prone to some fairly immature behavior when her life gets out of balance, which is often. Before they leave the party, Rory tries to make the peace and asks Emily to come to her second birthday party, but Emily just really coldly replies that they're busy that night, and holy shit, that is like the coldest moment ever, because it just reveals what Emily is capable of when she thinks she's been wronged. And if you take that exact moment and expand it out another 17 or 18 years, that's pretty much what happened between Lorelai and Emily. And Lorelai, of course, isn't going to take the sitting down, so she confronts Emily before they leave, and we get another in a long line of memorable arguments between them, and of course it's going on while Emily is bossing around the housekeeping staff.
Mom, come to the party tomorrow.
I can't, I'm busy. Throw those out, we won't eat them.
Mom, your granddaughter invited you to her birthday party. Please, come.
I've already been to a party for my granddaughter, and she humiliated me in front of all my friends. I have no desire to relive that experience. The cheeses must be put in individual bags, please.
Mom, come on, give her a break. You invited all these Chilton kids without even asking her.
They're her schoolmates. I assume they were her friends.
Well, you know what they say when people assume things.
No, what do they say?
That you shouldn't.
Very clever.
Mom, she didn't want them here. She doesn't like them.
Well, I had to invite them. That's just good manners, something that your daughter is sorely lacking.
God, you know, you're doing the same thing to her that you always did to me. You try to control her, and when that doesn't work, you just shut her out.
I'm too tired for your accusations right now. Can we do this tomorrow?
I'm just...
Here, I'll find you a pen so you can write down your insults so that you won't forget them.
Mom, this is not funny. I have a crushed kid out in the car.
What do you want me to say? Everything's fine. It's forgotten. There, I'll see you next week.
So I guess the whole pudding thing was just a fluke, huh? Trying to get to know us, easing up on the rules, smudging that bottom line of yours. It was just some weird phase. What, you were on cold medicine last week or something?
Oh, so I'm a villain now, is that it? I spent a fortune on this party. I spent days planning it, making sure that every little detail was perfect. The food, the linen, the music. And I did all this for Rory.
Well, that's not what she needed, Mom. What she needs is for you to accept her apology and come to her party. That's what she needs. But you don't care what she needs.
How dare you?
You don't even know what she needs because you don't know her. You've never tried to know her, just like you never knew me.
Oh, I know you.
Oh, please, you don't know anything about me.
Oh, you'd like to think that, wouldn't you? That you're just some huge mystery to me. Why does Lorelai do that? I don't know. She's a mystery to me. Well, you're not so mysterious. Lorelai.
No, what am I then?
Well, right now you're very loud and disruptive to the entire cleaning process. For God's sake, what do I have to do to get you to put the damn cheese in individual bags?
Fine, I give up.
Oh, you give up? If I had a dollar for every time you gave up.
Then you could pay for this party, couldn't you?
There's two things about this. First of all, who doesn't love to hear Emily barking domestic orders? That just never gets old. And second of all, if you look at the scene like this in the context of the entire series, it's incredibly impressive to me how good a handle the writers and the actors already had on the characters this early on. You know, a lot of times when you look back on the very early episodes of even a really good show, you can see how they were working out some of the kinks and the characters don't quite feel like the characters yet, but that's really not true here. They really hit the ground running, and this feels very consistent with the writing and acting much later down the road. Anyway, move on to Saturday night in Stars Hollow, in Rory's second birthday party, aka the one that actually looks fun. It's more laid back, boisterous, better music, not full of boring business people and socialites, and, you know, I really tried to do some detailed compare and contrast here to see if there was anything about Emily and Richard's party that was more appealing. The only potential aspect I came up with is that they had a professional bartender, perhaps the same one, perhaps the same one who would later go on to invent the Rory, which is a drink from, I think, Rory's 21st birthday party, but even so, Lorelai is a pretty big boozer, so I imagine her liquor cabinet is always well stocked, so even on that front, the elder Gilmores don't have much of an advantage. In any case, who would not want to be at a party that has both alcohol and Miss Patty? There's no competing with that. She has all the stories. Another note on the scene, I thought Dave and perhaps others would appreciate seeing Rory open her big present from Lorelai, which is the bright blue clamshell iBook, some vintage Johnny Ive design work there.
The toilet seat.
Yes, the toilet seat. So we're in the middle of this enjoyable madness when Emily and Richard actually do show up after it, after all. And Lorelai is completely thrown. It's like a super amplified version of that moment that inevitably happens at parties where you have to integrate friends from one aspect of your life into another. And you're like, oh, you guys don't know these people. I hope you get along. But in fact, it turns out to be a really significant event here because right after they come in, when Lorelai is getting Emily a drink in the kitchen, she tells Suki that Emily and Richard have literally never been inside her house once ever in the entire decade and a half that they've lived there. And that isn't really dwelled on for very long, but it just shows how big of a rift there is in this relationship. It's not your typical falling out. And then Luke arrives shortly thereafter carrying two bags of ice, and Emily is there to see Lorelai greet him, and some great eye work by Kelly Bishop in that moment. She knows there's something between them, even if they don't know yet, and they won't act on it for another 4 years. But Luke happens to show up at the exact moment that Lorelai has run out of ice, and he very correctly says that you can never have enough ice at a party. Podcast listeners, if you take nothing else away from this, from this entire canon submission, heed Luke's words, you always need more ice at a party than you think you do.
It's damn good counsel.
Again, the more you know. Stars. So after that, Emily follows Lorelai upstairs to her room and kind of pokes around at her things. It's really nicely underplayed, again, because it's the first time Emily's been here, and she's definitely using the opportunity to absorb some information about Lorelai's life, even if she's not saying that's what she's doing. And then we get this nice exchange between them.
It's quite an assortment of characters you've assembled down there.
They're great people.
This Patricia.
Miss Patty.
She teaches dance.
Among other things.
And this man with the ice.
Luke.
How long have you been seeing him?
Luke? I'm not seeing Luke. He's just a friend. Mom, I swear, Luke keeps me in coffee. Nothing else.
He seems to like you.
And you're judging this by what?
By the way he looked at you.
Which was how?
Like you were about to give him a lap dance.
Mom, he did not look at me like that.
You're pleased.
What?
You smiled. You're pleased that the Iceman looked at you like a porterhouse steak.
I'm smiling because you're crazy, and that's what you do to crazy people to keep them calm.
What's this?
Well, that's me, Ma.
I know it's you. You're wearing a cast.
Yeah, that's when I broke my leg.
You broke your leg?
Yeah, 3 years ago during a yoga class. The headstand portion took a very ugly turn. The good thing was that I brought the smug blonde pretzel chick down with me. I've since learned that I'm a bit too competitive for yoga.
I never knew you broke your leg.
It was no big deal, Mom. If I'd been really sick, you would have known.
Yeah.
I have to say, you're pleased that the Iceman looked at you like a porterhouse steak is maybe my favorite piece of Amy Sherman Palladino dialogue in history. There are a lot of competitors. Of course, a huge contrast to the earlier scene where they're yelling at each other, but there's still a lot going on here. This is basically about Emily desperately wanting to have knowledge of Lorelai's life and not having it, realizing that she doesn't. And even though she can savor that one little moment of intuition about the sexual tension with Luke, the moment where she sees that photograph of Lorelai in the cast takes it all away. And it's clearly that moment of realizing that all those years of Lorelai being on her own with zero support from Emily and Richard, she was pretty much fine. Even when something bad happened, like breaking her leg, she got through all that on her own. And that can be a tough thing, even in a fairly healthy relationship, for parents of adult children to cope with the fact that the kids are self-sufficient now and the parenting services aren't really needed anymore. But it's particularly devastating for Emily because they've been apart for so long and Lorelai formed so much of her identity without a shred of influence from her parents. So after the scene, there's kind of two endings to the episode. And the first one is when Emily and Richard leave the party and get into the car, and Emily says this.
Emily?
She's right. I don't know my daughter at all. We should go. Traffic.
So that feels like a perfect way to wrap up the episode, but the second ending is when we're back with Lorelai and Rory, and Rory sneaks out to see Dean so that he can give her a birthday present. Again, also a very short scene, and I'm thankful that this episode wasn't diluted with too much Dean stuff. But Lorelai sees him at the kitchen window.
Tara's shaking her head at your Dean.
I've had enough of your flagrant Dean bashing.
We'll get into this later. So Lorelai sees them and... you know, maybe, for one thing, maybe they should have found a slightly more covert spot for their canoodling than, like, right in the path of the kitchen window if they're trying to keep this relationship a secret. But the point being that Lorelai is getting a taste of what Emily felt, and there's this gap of understanding between her and Rory if Rory has to be hiding this from her, which is what they explore in the next few episodes after this. So wrap it up, I'd say that this, more than any other episode in the first season of Gilmore Girls, is the one that established the parameters of the truly dysfunctional relationship between Lorelai and her parents, and how Rory could get in the crossfire of that. And it's admirable that the writers never pretended that this was a rift that could be easily mended or even mended at all. It really never was. There was never a moment where they all finally bonded and everything was okay from then on. Every time there was a big disagreement or confrontation, it always came back to what we saw in this episode, which is that Emily and Richard just don't know or understand Lorelai. And deep down, they're just too limited to bridge that gap. And on the flip side, Lorelai is always going to be too headstrong to forgive and forget. And so as much as they might try to work around that, and sometimes they do successfully work around it, it's never going to stop being a problem at the deepest sense. So all of Emily's odd behavior throughout the series, all her insistence on adhering to archaic Emily Post stuff, and her obsession with various society type stuff, and Daughters of the American Revolution, and all of that stuff, and that she always ends up dragging Lorelai and Rory into, as ridiculous as that got, it's all rooted in this emotional wound that's very real. Like I said before, I think this is an example of a great episode of TV that, even by this show's standards, is very safe in terms of its content, but it's still genuinely moving and compelling. And even though TV in general has gotten a lot better in the 14 years since this aired, I think that's something that's been lost from the landscape of TV shows. It's not really something that's out there right now. The deck is really stacked with adult shows, whether they're on cable or networks. You know, we're talking about two of them earlier, you know, that really trying to push the envelope and stuff. But those are where the good TV is happening right now. And of course, I love all those shows. I love my True Detective and Breaking Bad and my incest and my beheadings and so forth. But those shows are all about pushing and pushing the boundaries. And I think it can be an even greater challenge to stay within more narrow boundaries and still make something memorable. This is an episode that would be entirely appropriate for an 11-year-old to watch with their parents. And yet I can watch it and enjoy it and not feel like it's talking down to me or glossing things over or playing it too safe. And I think it deserves a spot in the canon.
Well argued, Nick. I have just a few things to say about this episode before I throw it over to the others. One is that I can't not watch Gilmore Girls without Tara, because I think Tara sees a lot of her relationship with her mother in this show, and it makes it that much more enjoyable to watch, because she's kind of says, oh, that's true, that's the way it is, or this is how it was. I think this episode, with a couple tweaks to her boyfriend situation could be a pilot to the show. Everybody's relationship is explained. Everybody's situation is explained. The backstory is explained. Like, I don't know what happened in the first three episodes. I can't remember. But I don't think I didn't need to. Like,
there's actually six episodes in before they did this.
Yeah. So it's a really good primer for the show, as well being a very sweet episode. And I'm trying to, like, you're right that there's nothing like this, and I can't quite put my finger on what to call it. It's sort of like this, it's got like a bubblegum filter over everything, you know what? It's even the sour notes are still kind of sweet, you know? And my favorite part of this episode that kind of highlights that, there's a scene in the second party that's at the Gilmore Jr.'s house, where Rory's grandfather is sitting outside because he's sort of overwhelmed by everything that's going on at the party. It's this whole different dynamic going on.
And I've had that moment at so many parties.
And Rory brings him a Cosmopolitan to read just because she knows he just needs something to...
And she says she doesn't have The Economist.
That's right.
No, it's actually Barron's, and that's what got me on board with the episode, that's exactly what my dad would wish was there and wouldn't be.
And she suggests he does the, you know, what season color are you quiz. And, you know, at the end they have a little, you know, I'm an autumn, which I predicted that he was an autumn. And I was right. Yeah. It's a good episode of Gilmore Girls. It is an indicative episode of Gilmore Girls, and you're totally right that its tone is something that sort of has fallen away in the current landscape, and it's nice to watch it again.
It's interesting that you brought up like the sort of two axes that we judge canons on, which is it good by itself, and also is it representative of what it is? Mm-hmm. I'm still not sure how I'm going to vote. I wanted to hear what everyone else had to say. I had watched maybe half an episode of Gilmore Girls before this and just thought it was twee. It was not for me. I don't even remember what episode it was, but this one was light on Luke, which I enjoyed. Never bought the chemistry between those two. Like, when Emily's going on and on about how, like, he's looking at you like you're a steak dinner, I was like, no, he's not.
Apparently, the rumor at the time was that the reason it took so long for those two characters to get together was that the actors did not care for each other.
I think I heard that also.
Mm-hmm. Continue.
And Lauren Graham, sometimes I like. More often, I really don't. It took me a while to adjust to her character on Parenthood, and I know that's the writing, and it's not terribly fair to her at times, but she can be a lot, that actress, and not always good. But what is the actress's name who plays Emily?
Kelly Bishop.
She's wonderful in this. I loved the little, like, half of 1% references, like that Barron's part. Like, there was something that was so affectionate about that granddaughter relationship. Just that easy fondness that they have. It is very important to keep your cheeses separate. Like,
I knew that was going to come.
Exactly right.
There's no like cartoonishness to this. Like, it is sort of candy colored, like Dave said, but there's no one, like, everyone is well shaded. And I thought that those arguments that they were having, these conversations, they were maybe a little writerly, but they also felt truthful, like we were saying before about True Detective. So I don't know if I would keep watching this, but I think it's absolutely representative of what the show could be at its best. And it was an entertaining hour. So, Tara, bring the experienced perspective to us, please.
I'm turning the mic around. I feel like I should be cracking my knuckles. What Dave was alluding to is that, and I can't remember if it's come up on the podcast ever, as opposed to in this mark of in this run of episodes, but the reason that he says he needs me as a guide when we watch Gilmore Girls is that my mother was quite young when I was born, and she was a single mom for the first 5 years of my life too. And so, and she also fell out with her mother when she got pregnant unexpectedly in high school. So a lot of this is, you know, they got back together sooner than Lorelai and Emily did, but a lot of this rings true to me, and, you know, we lived it. And the other thing I would say, just as a side note, if you're looking for more shows that are like this, ABC Family is actually doing really good work. I know it has a reputation for being all Jesus-y, but it's not. Switched at Birth and The Fosters are both really good shows that are similarly pitched, have a lot of things in common where they, you know, treat the kids and the parents with equal, like, affection and seriousness.
Carrie Diaries also.
Yeah, Carrie Diaries is another great example. Not so much the CW anymore, other than Carrie Diaries. I feel like it's all versions of the Vampire Diaries.
Vampires and
Scottish aliens Queens. And whatever, yeah. But... Yeah, Randy.
And Dean.
And Dean, right.
Still.
Yeah. Still Dean.
You can't kill him.
I won't get into Dean. I did love him at the time, and he was a perfect boyfriend until they had to do something with his character and set her up with fucking Jess, the worst.
Who played that guy? It was Zuckerberg, right?
Who played who? Dean?
Jess.
No, Zuckerberg didn't come until later. Jess was Milo Ventimiglia.
Oh. Yeah.
Exactly.
Nope.
Who borrowed her book and wrote in it.
I know. I know.
End of conversation. Oh, like, it's the worst. Writing his own fucking observations in her book. No. Just
especially
no.
That guy. No.
I don't even remember what book it was, but whatever it was. Anyway. What I love about this episode is that it is the progression that Emily goes through in it. And you can tell, as you say, that it's going to be a lifelong thing, that she's going to have problems. But, like, the pudding is one step, and then wanting to throw the party is another, because she's just reconnected with Rory, someone that, until this season of the show started, we get the impression they've barely had any contact at all. And so part of it is that she wants to spend Rory's birthday with her, because this might be the first time she's ever done it. And also, she has an idea in her mind of, like, when you have a granddaughter, this is the kind of party that you throw for her, because it's partly a showcase for you and in your place in society, but also partly you're bragging on her, like, this is my granddaughter, and this is how I show her off, whether it's what she wants or not, it's not. And so that Rory did not know what, as you say, all the other Chilton kids knew, which is how to play along with that script, is especially insulting to Emily, because she feels like, oh, I fucked up because I wasn't in her life to teach her how to act properly. And in addition to that, she's embarrassing me. So it's like, it's both of those things at once, which is why that fight with Lorelai is so tense, because it's like, there's so many years of, like, calloused resentment between both of them, and they both have reasons to be mad at the other. And so that's why it's such a big deal when they show up to the other party and, like, in their civvies, like, they've dressed in the way that they think they should dress. And Rory's like, you don't have a bow tie on. Like, maybe she's never seen him without a bow tie on before. Is great.
That actor you could see just sleeping with one, or like he had an implant. Totally.
Absolutely. And that she decides to buy the bracelets that are only $12, like, that's progress. Like, she does want to get there. She doesn't know how to get there, though. And so that's why it's so important for Lorelai to be tolerant of her, which she mostly is, even though she's an extremely frustrating character and person to deal with. So that's why I love this episode, that it has so much love and understanding of all of the characters, including Rory, who's, like, in the middle in the horrible way, and it spends most of the series in that position too, including, like, times when she's not talking to Lorelai many years hence. So I think, as Dave said, if this were the pilot, it would have been a very strong pilot, but that it's come at this point is, like, it's sort of a signal of how ambitious the show is going to be about these relationships and how seriously and thoughtfully it has taken them and drawn them.
Okay, so it is time to vote. Tara.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yay.
Sarah?
My wife makes some very good points about mother-daughter relationships and their failure to resolve. So I may even keep watching the show, but even if I don't, my vote is yes.
I'm also going to vote yes. I do want to say good point about ABC Family, although it's interesting that these shows are almost ghettoized to that one network now, eh?
Yeah, kind of, but also yeah. ABC Family is one of the channels that shows Gilmore Girls in syndication.
Ah, there you go. I will also vote yes, so that means you are 3-4-3.
Nick.
Gilmore Girls, Season 1, Episode 6, Rory's Birthday Parties. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara, you have our winner.
If we had been doing this last week when we originally were supposed to, I would have said the winner of the week was Broad City, because my favorite new show got picked up for a second season. But since it's a week later, I will say, hooray, winner of the week is Kroll Show, which got picked up for a third season. I don't quite love it as much as Broad City, but I love it a lot. And I'm very happy that it will be back for another season.
And a loser?
Well, I thought that Mindy Project would be a loser, but that also got picked up for a third season, to the shock of all. I just wanted to shoehorn that in somewhere.
Nice.
The loser is a little bit dated, but any chance to stick it to Spuffy Shippers, I will take it. Spuffy Shippers. Sarah Michelle Gellar did an actually really informative and lovely AMA on Reddit, and she was asked like a gazillion times, like, who, you know, who should Buffy?
Angel or Spike?
Yeah, Angel or Spike. And she was like, Angel. And they kept coming at her like, what if Spike was taller? Angel. Well, what if Spike hadn't become a ghost on Angel? Angel. Like, she's like, look.
What if Angel. Spike tried to rape somebody else?
Yeah.
We're out of Spike rolls.
We're so out of Spike rolls. All these years later, remembering the havoc that Spuffy Shippers tended to wreak on internet websites, it was just nice to have it confirmed by someone on the inside. Angel's obviously the better pick, even though Boreanaz is a total weirdo who's afraid of chickens.
What?
Yeah.
Is that real?
Yeah,
I think it's actually on YouTube.
Just live ones? Or what if you give him like a KFC bucket? Does he freak out?
Oh, yeah, no, it's live ones. Okay. And then Letterman, like... like, oh, there's a chicken backstage, and like he literally like sweat. He was like, just kidding. And then they totally cut to like there was obviously a chicken. Its name was Margot. It was like in a cage.
That's adorable.
Yeah, I know. Oh, Margot the chicken.
I have a question for everybody.
I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Can I have a pen? Because I forgot a pen.
It's pen time.
My favorite time.
All right, everybody, this is the third game time of the season. Current standings are Tara, 0, Sarah, 1, Valued Guests, 1.
So technically, Bunting's 2 in this
Bunting's
case.
Bunting's 2, Ariane.
Today's game time comes from frequent contributor, Rob Hartman, who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot, great topic of his choosing. By the way, those mini topics will happen next week. No minis this week. Sorry about that. Today, we are playing Lost in Translation. In this game, I am going to read you the literal translation of an American show's title from a foreign land. You have to tell me what show we're talking about. That's it. That's all we do. Are you ready to play?
Why are you looking at me like that, Dave?
Lost in Translation.
We need our order.
Oh, yes. Tara's going first. We're going to skip Picky. We're running late. Tara's first, then we'll go Nick, Sarah. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Are we ready to play Lost in Translation, everybody?
Not really.
Sort of.
Let's do it.
All right. So, Tara.
Yes.
So we scroll up. Here we go. Inventing Truth from Brazil. Inventing Truth, and that show is from Brazil.
Inventing Truth.
Inventing Truth.
The X-Files?
Incorrect. That show, Mad Men. Mad Men in Brazil is known as Inventing Truth. Okay, Nick.
Yes.
Fiery Boys.
Fiery Boys?
Fiery Boys from Croatia. Croatia.
Let's see. Oh, fire. The Devil-y show, I can't remember. Supernatural?
Sorry. Wrong button. Wrong button.
That made so much sense, though.
The Devil-y show.
The Fiery Boys is Rescue Me.
Oh, never
Rescue
mind.
Me.
Oh.
All right, Sarah.
Yep.
The show is Staying Alive from Russia.
Staying Alive. Survivor? Staying
Alive. Close. Lost. Oh. A live-action Survivor.
Lost always fucks me somehow.
Tara.
Yes.
The Man of Law from Hungary.
The Man of Law.
Yeah.
The Man of Law. Just one man.
The Man of Law. They watched that in Hungary. The show we know as...
Shark? Nick has a guess.
Yeah.
Oh, so does Sarah.
Oh, okay.
Is it Justified?
It is Justified.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I was going to guess Walker, Texas Ranger. I will let myself out.
Okay. At First Glance, Nick. At First Glance from Finland.
At first glance, The Mentalist?
How I Met Your Mother.
What?
How I Met Your Mother.
Wow.
Okay. Sarah.
Uh-huh.
Open Heart.
This could be a medical show. This could be a
From
dating
France.
Show.
Open Heart.
Bachelor.
Damn it. It should be The Bachelor.
Grey's Anatomy.
God damn it.
All right. From Estonia.
Yeah.
King of Withdrawal.
King of Withdrawal.
Yep.
House?
What?
Boardwalk Empire.
What?
Because of booze. Everybody's...
But,
and he's the king of prohibition, so it probably...
Screw you, other countries.
Also, no one even stops... Okay.
Nick. From Hungary, Hard Rider. Hard Rider.
Oh, man, I have so many jokes to... Knight Rider?
Oh, no, we broke Sarah. That show, Sons of Anarchy.
Sons of
Anarchy. Okay. Sarah? My Husband's Defense, also from Hungary. My Husband's Defense.
My Husband's Defense. Prison Break.
Tara, you know what this is?
Everybody Loves Raymond?
The Good Wife.
Do we have any points?
No one has gotten one right.
No.
This is a soccer game.
Tara.
Yeah.
Great Tremendous Blast from Iran. Iran. My apologies. Great Tremendous Blast from Iran.
The Dave Show.
Great Tremendous Blast from Iran.
I mean, I know it's not Super Fun Night because that hasn't been on long enough to be in Iran.
Nor would they be able to show that in Iran.
Great Tremendous Blast.
Gonna need an answer.
Party Down.
Big Bang Theory.
Oh.
Yes.
Nick. Hunting the Spy from Italy. Hunting the Spy.
Oh, is that Homeland?
The seal is broken.
Sarah.
Yes.
Invincible Duo from Slovenia. Invincible
Duo. If only
Duo.
That were the whole title. Invincible Duo from Slovenia. Invincible Duo? Supernatural?
Suits.
They're quite vincible.
Tara.
Yeah.
Sweet Fibs from Poland. Sweet Fibs. Sweet Fibs.
Everybody Loves Raymond.
Pretty Little Liars. Sweet Fibs. All right, Nick.
Yeah.
In the Shoes of Satan. From Bulgaria.
In the Shoes of Satan?
Oh.
Oh, man. Okay. Supernatural?
I would have guessed that again too.
Breaking Bad is known as In the Shoes of Satan in Bulgaria.
The big issue with him was his shoes.
Sarah.
Yes.
Drink and Let Live from Hungary. Drink and Let Live.
Cougar Town.
Good guess.
True Blood. True Blood.
Oh, boo. Shut up, Hungary.
Tara.
Yeah.
The Search for the Dream Guy from Denmark. Lawa.
The Search for the Dream Guy.
Denmark.
The Mindy Project?
Bachelorette.
Oh,
Bachelorette.
Really?
All right, number 17.
Spread Eagle.
For Nick. From Greece, Play Crown.
Game of Thrones.
Correct. Sarah.
Yes.
From Russia, Losers. If you think this one through, you'll get it. But you have to think in a certain way. So you might not get it.
Don't tell her that.
Okay.
It's not helpful.
No, it's not.
Oh.
Oh, or maybe it is.
What way should I be thinking? Dave.
I don't know if I'm right.
With my forehead. That doesn't really help me at all. Benson.
Oh.
Losers.
Glee.
L sign on my forehead. All right.
I thought the biggest loser. That would have been too obvious.
I didn't even get that.
Okay, back to Tara.
Yeah.
Race around the world from Hungary.
Is it the Amazing Race?
Yay! Tara's at a point. This is my favorite one of the game for Nick.
Good luck, Nick.
From Greece, I know what you ate last summer.
Okay, well, it's probably not Hannibal.
What if it is?
The biggest loser?
Wow! Holy moly! Wow. Nicely done.
All right, this one will take us into our score break for Sarah.
Yes.
Horror Kitchen.
Hell's Kitchen.
Nice.
All right.
All right, Sarah and I are tied with one each. Nick has three.
All right. Well, needless to say, it is anybody's game. I think that brought us, I don't know, two-fifths of the way through or okay. So.
Wow.
Did I say there were 60 questions? There's 60 questions.
Okay.
Okay, so...
Me.
Three men and a girl from Finland.
New Girl.
Correct. From Estonia, for Nick, Final Good, All Good.
Final Good, All Good?
Yep.
Final Good, All Good. Who wants to be a millionaire?
Happy ending. Final Good, All Good.
Of course.
Okay, Sarah. Urban Development Department from Hungary. Urban Development Department.
Parks and Rec?
Nice!
Tara.
Yes.
Hard Neck from Finland. Hard Neck.
Ew. Hard Neck?
Yep. Hard Neck.
House?
I'll give you a hint. It's on the Dolphin Blowjob Network, otherwise known as USA.
Burn Notice?
No, White Collar.
Oh, of course.
White Collar.
Okay. I just want to know when we're going to get to Steak Face already.
For Nick,
yeah.
From Poland, on the border of the worlds.
Oh, on the border of the worlds. Well, it can't be Game of Thrones. We already had that.
But not for this country, maybe.
No repeats like that.
No repeats? Okay, thank you.
He says, scanning.
Supernatural? It's got to be right sometime.
Get a good guess.
It's a show that involves multiple universes. It's recent. It's from Bad Robot.
Awake?
Fringe.
Fringe, oh. Sure.
All right, Sarah from Finland. Evil Track.
Evil Track?
Yeah, like choo-choo track.
Right. Evil Track.
If you need time to discuss this with your friend, I'll understand.
Now I just am obsessed with a show about trains, which that's not a thing. Benson.
The Following. I even gave you a hit.
I know, you
an
did.
Extra hit.
Oh, no.
Poor Pohead. Sorry.
For Tara.
Yes.
Figurehead from Poland. Figurehead. Figurehead. That was a pretty good title for this show.
Veep? Whoa!
Nice.
Nick. Empty Pockets from Finland.
Two Broke Girls?
Correct. This is a good one. Estonia. Archer.
Archer?
And I'm going to let you know it's not Archer.
Arrow.
Nice.
Back to Tara.
Yep.
My Cool Uncle Charlie.
2 and a Half Men?
Germany says 2 and a Half Men.
Inaccurate title, I'd like to say.
My Cool Uncle Charlie. Nick.
Yeah.
From the Czech Republic, The Bone Collector.
Bones?
Sometimes it's right there. Sarah from Greece. Fact or fiction? Question mark. Fact or fiction? Question mark.
Fact or fiction? Lie to me?
Good guess.
That was my guess, too.
Mythbusters.
Oh.
Tara.
Yep.
Who are you, Doc? From Hungary.
I mean, I feel it. House?
Oh, my God.
What?
Say it backwards.
Oh. Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Oh.
Doctor Who. Who are you, Doc?
That would have been my guess, too. No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nick. Out of this world from Poland.
It's not out of this world.
No, I kind of want to go for it again. Out of this... Oh, Third Rock from the Sun?
It's Supernatural.
Oh, oh, God.
Not only that, but we have to stop guessing it now.
Oh, man.
That was great. Well, I'm not saying Supernatural.
Did you reorder the questions on purpose? Or just go?
That was awesome. Okay, taking us into our second score break. For Sarah, from Croatia, the show is known as Editorial.
Editorial. Ugly Betty?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see it. The Newsroom.
Oh.
The Newsroom.
The News Poo.
All right.
All right. Sarah has 3, I have 4, Nick has 5.
Done.
All right. All right, so we're back to Tara.
Yep.
The City of Resistance from Hungary.
The City of Resistance.
Yep. The City of Resistance. Gonna need an answer.
Law and Order.
Defiance. Defiance. That city is St. Louis, I believe. Okay, Nick.
Yeah.
From Spain. The Unfaithfuls. The Unfaithfuls.
The Unfaithfuls. Oh, Mistresses?
Nice.
Ooh.
Good. For Sarah, from Finland, of kin. Of kin.
Of kin. My mind is completely empty to shows about siblings. Gilmore Girls.
Parenthood. Parenthood. Tara, here's a tough one.
Yes.
Flaming Chicago from Hungary.
Is it Chicago Fire?
Correct. Nick, also a tough one. From Russia, Wiretapping.
Supernatural. The Wire.
Correct. Sarah, from Romania, Military Justice.
Oh, Navally. NCIS?
Oh, no! Is it the other one?
No!
That sucks. Yes.
My Insane Family from Romania.
Arrested Development?
Family Guy.
Oh.
It's every show. Come on.
Yeah.
Nick.
Yeah.
From Hungary. Dance if you can.
Oh, so you think you can dance?
Correct. Excellent. For Sarah.
Oh, I'm still mad.
From Greece. Juvenile Concerns.
Juvenile Concerns.
Yeah.
Teen Mom?
Oh, good guess. A little show we know as Dawson's Creek.
I love how every show is one that I consider is one that's trying to screw me. And I'm like, ew.
Tara.
Meddling Kids?
Yes.
I kind of want to... This is good. I like this title anyways. From Estonia.
Yes.
Murder Preventive Times. Murder Preventive Times.
Person of Interest?
Ooh.
Oh, nicely done.
For Nick.
Yeah.
From France. The Experts Las Vegas.
The Experts Las Vegas. CSI?
Correct. Sarah, from France. Bob of the Sea.
Bob of the Sea? I think I knew this one, actually. SpongeBob SquarePants.
Nice.
Oh, Tara.
Still me. Yes.
Stars Training from Hungary. Stars Training.
It's one of two, so I'm going to flip a coin in my head. American Idol or Pop Idol.
And what was the other one?
Dancing with the Stars.
Dance Moms.
Ah!
Oh.
Okay, Nick.
Yeah.
This is a good one, too. From France, investigator despite himself.
Monk?
Good guess. Psych.
Damn it, another Blue Sky show. Yeah.
Who gives more, Sarah, from Spain? Who gives more? Who gives more?
Who gives more?
Yeah, who gives more? That's great.
Undercover Boss.
Oh, I like that.
You're on the right, sort of the right track. Storage Wars.
Oh.
Storage Wars.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
From Spain.
Yes. Oh, no.
I keep it just in case.
It's obviously Hannibal.
Transparent? Just kidding. Not transparent. I keep it just in case.
From Spain.
Shark Tank.
Oh, you're going to kick yourself when you hear it.
What?
Yeah.
What?
It's probably Hoarders, right?
Yeah, it's Hoarders.
On the spot, I wouldn't have gotten it either.
Nick.
Yeah.
From Estonia. The President's Team. The President's Team.
It got to be the West Wing.
Correct for a point, taking us into our last score break before we end. This is not the end. This is our last score break. From Spain, for Sarah, an ass going downhill. An ass going downhill.
Breaking Bad.
We've had Breaking Bad already.
Oh.
Benson. Breaking Bad was the guy who wears devil shoes or whatever.
Oh, right.
It is not Benson. That's Eastbound and Down. An ass going downhill.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Fair.
All right. Everybody has two questions left.
Well, I think Nick has won this one.
Yes.
But Sarah has 4. I have 6. Nick has 10.
Whoa. All right.
Nick has a very international mind, apparently.
Okay, Tara.
Yeah.
Your penultimate question.
Mm-hmm.
From Slovenia.
Right.
Police family.
Blue Bloods.
Sure.
All right. From Poland, Nick.
Yeah.
Banana Doctor.
That's a porn title, isn't it? House?
No, another Blue Sky show.
Oh, the Royal Pains?
Yeah, Royal Pains.
Yes, of course. That's the banana show. Yeah.
Okay.
You know all the bananas they have in the Hamptons?
Sarah.
Yes.
I believe you may have given this as an incorrect answer earlier in the game.
That
from Germany.
Narrow it down.
From Germany. 40 is the new 20! 40 is the new 20. And they apologize for it every week in the credits.
They sure do.
Cougar Town?
Yeah, very sorry! All right, last question for Tara.
Yep.
Lady Doctor in Alabama. From Spain.
Heart of Dixie.
All right, from Hungary, your last question, Nick.
Yeah.
Juror enemies, colon, humiliated victims.
Whoa. Juror enemies, the rural juror enemies, colon, humiliated victims.
What?
Wow.
Juror enemies, humiliated victims. It's all in there.
Law and Order Trial by Jury?
Ow! So close. Law and Order Special Victims Unit. Humiliated victims.
Yeah, they are humiliated, I guess.
Now they are. Jeez.
Jury. And last one for Sarah.
Yep.
Think about this one. It's a tough one. From Poland. Do not mess with a witch out of 23. Do not mess with a witch out of 23.
Out of 23?
Yeah. Do not mess with a witch out of 23.
Charmed?
No.
Don't trust the bee in apartment 23.
Correct.
Oh.
All right. Let's make it official with our score break.
Sarah has 5, I have 8, Nick has 10.
All right, here we go, shits and giggles. First one to shout out the correct answer wins a coveted day point, redeemable for possibly something in a possible future. We're not quite sure. Who's to say when they're going to pop up and what you're going to want them for?
I am, and I hope nothing is going to come of it.
I hope you've been keeping track of all your day points.
I have.
Writing them down on a piece of paper, logging them in an Excel spreadsheet. The show from Japan is known as Macaroni Rascals.
Top Chef.
Sarah's out. Macaroni Rascals.
Oh,
polite translate. Yes.
The Sopranos?
That is the polite translation. Apparently, the more sort of, you could also translate it into macaroni assholes.
Still would get
kitchen nightmares?
Macaroni rascals / assholes in Japan is the show we know as Jersey Shore.
Oh, of course it is.
Wow.
I think that's close.
All right, everybody, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We chewed the fat on Hannibal's season seconds and then went around the dial with stops at, oh boy, it wasn't Believe, but it was
True Detective.
It wasn't Scandal, but it was
Mad Men,
The Americans, and Feed Me. Nick invited us to Rory's birthday parties for the canon, and we RSVP'd yes. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Nick was the winner of this week's game time, which reminds me, we didn't
do the thingy.
Valued guess.
Remember, everybody,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Porterhouse Steak, if you're lucky,
Sarah D. Bunting,
Amuse Douche,
and Nick Reinwell Jones.
For God's sake, what do I have to do to get you to put the damn cheese in individual bags?
We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great. And in the meantime, we'll see you on the previously.tv forums, where you're going to be starting topics.
Does the head cheese get its own drawer?
I've had to draw a conclusion based on what I glimpsed through the stitching of the person suit that you wear. And the conclusion that I've drawn is that you are dangerous.
I'm sorry you feel that way.
Please don't come to my home again. I will see myself out.
Yes.